I wish I had your faith, he said to me, but I don't. His name actually was Tom. Ironic coincidence, I later thought. He was a student with me in the same student residences that I was living in many years ago now. He'd been coming to church, as I understood it, for years. In fact, most people assumed he was a Christian. He was so much part of the chapel furniture. But he confessed to me that day in our college block when we were having some coffee together, I think it was, that he really didn't feel he was a Christian, not deep down. I sit in the congregation in church every Sunday, he said, and I feel like some kind of spiritual monstrosity, a fish out of water. What do I do, Roy? I've got all these doubts. I really want to believe. But I don't. He had some affinity, didn't he, with his namesake, Thomas, here in John chapter 20, called Didymus. For Thomas was the odd one out, too. Just picture him as he returns to his old friends. Was it Sunday night, Monday morning? He comes back anxious to commiserate with them about the death of the man that they had all centered their life around for 3 years. I guess he expected to find them grieving and depressed, just as they had been when he left them. On Friday, was it? Saturday? Well, that was a bad Friday. The day when that cross had stood silhouetted against the Jerusalem sky and had shattered all their dreams. He had seen it with his own eyes. The Master had died. And yet now Thomas comes back to his friends a few days later to find them jubilant, muttering some preposterous story about Jesus having risen from the dead. Suddenly, Thomas just didn't feel he belonged anymore. Of course, church can have that effect on a lot of people. I remember when I first went to church, I had no background in church going at all. The first time I entered a church was in my mid-teens as an inquirer. And one of the first things I discovered was the unique way these Christians had of making you feel at home and uncomfortable both at the same time. Well, from your laughter, I guess you've noticed that too. I wonder whether, even amongst us, there are those who feel an element of empathy with Thomas, who don't really feel we belong here among the hymn books and the Bibles. Maybe this feels like an alien culture. Maybe if the truth were known, you'd feel rather more relaxed back home in front of the TV or with a beer in your hand down in a local bar than you do in this strange smell of varnish that seems to percolate Victorian chapels. Or maybe, like my friend Tom, you are all too familiar with the odour of ecclesiastical sanctity because you were brought up in church. Maybe all your family are Christians. But still, for you personally, it has never really deep down clicked. Or maybe you thought it clicked once, but it doesn't really do so anymore. Or perhaps you're still involved in church, and as a result, many people think you are a Christian. Maybe you even try to kid yourself that you are one, but deep down in your heart, you have this fear, this anxiety, that really your experience is not the same as everybody else's. You're not a believer like their believers, not really. But as I say, if any of those profiles fit, this passage of the Bible was written for you. Because that's exactly how Thomas felt. He was the odd one out, a solitary skeptic in an ocean of believers. Indeed, when you look at it, he seems to have been quite a determined skeptic. Do you notice what he says at one point? Not, "I don't believe it." I will not believe it. Well, I want to invite you in this fourth of our studies, drawn from George MacDonald's Unspoken Sermons, to look at the experience of Thomas. He has something to teach us about doubt. He has something to teach us about the nature of faith, or as George MacDonald called it, the higher faith. I want to suggest to you, first of all, two things Thomas got right. Two things he got right about faith. And then I want to identify three things that I think he got wrong. Let me share with you the two things I think he got right, first of all. The first thing that I like about Thomas, which I'm sure he got right, was the honesty he shows about his doubts. At least he didn't try to pretend, did he? Now, many people do. I don't blame them. I mean, you must have been in a group sometime when someone told a joke. A joke that everybody else found hysterically funny, except you. You know, you couldn't see the joke. What do you do in a situation like that? I'll tell you what you do. You laugh too, don't you? Maybe not quite so hysterically as the others. Maybe there's a slight time lag before you catch up. But you laugh. You don't want to be mocked for your stupidity and not understanding the humour. So you fake it. Now, some people, I think, do engage in a somewhat similar pretense in church, and I don't blame them. They want to be accepted, well, we all do. Maybe it matters a lot to them because they are lonely. Maybe family connections make it impossible for them to opt out of this Christian community. Whatever reason, they conform to the pattern. They learn all the choruses by heart. They sing the hymns with every appearance of emotional involvement. They adopt the evangelical cliches when they greet people or sign off their letters. They even learn to pray spiritual sounding prayers. In short, to all external appearance, they take on the persona of a Christian. But it is actually just a pretense. An understandable pretense. Not a wicked, sinful, hypocritical pretense, certainly. Just a perfectly understandable adoption of a convenient socio-cultural stereotype. Rather like the way some Americans modify their accents, I notice, when they come to London. Let's face it takes courage to admit you don't belong, to make yourself conspicuous in a group where everybody else seems agreed, you know? It takes guts to do that. Well, I admire Thomas at this point. At least he didn't fall into the cowardly trap of faking it, did he? He wasn't going to say he had faith just to fit in. He couldn't turn faith on like a tap, and he wasn't about to pretend he could. This, quote, Jesus is risen from the dead stuff, did not seem plausible to him at all. He could think of a dozen explanations for his bereaved friend's strange new euphoria that were far more likely than a death-defying miracle. There were ghosts and hallucinations and collective hysteria and self-hypnosis. It could be loads of things. He was a skeptic, and he said so. That was brave. And in my view, it was absolutely the right thing to do, because honesty matters. Not just to me. It matters to God. God is not impressed by imitation faith. How could he be? He is the God of truth. And that means he is more concerned about our intellectual integrity than we are ourselves. A profession of faith that's achieved only at the expense of that integrity doesn't please him. As King David put it long ago in the Psalms, thou desirest truth in the inward parts, he says. So that was the first thing I think Thomas did that was right. He was honest about his doubts. The second thing I think he was quite right about is a little more controversial. I think he was right in his demand for evidence. Now, in a moment, I will make some qualifications on this point, so don't judge me too fast. There are undoubtedly some aspects of the kind of evidence that Thomas demanded which I think are less praiseworthy. But in principle, asking for evidence of some kind to substantiate faith, it seems to me, is not only perfectly legitimate, but absolutely necessary. Now, I have to say, this is controversial. Not all Christians would agree with me on this point. Some have suggested that faith at its highest does not require any evidence at all. Indeed, they hold that faith is more authentic when the evidence is against it. There was a famous Danish philosopher called Søren Kierkegaard in the 19th century who took just this line. After all, he said, if you've got evidence, what do you need faith for? Faith, he says, by definition, is the spiritual opposite of mathematical logic and empirical science. Faith is an irrational hope grasped as a preferable alternative to the bleak, even suicidal prospect of existential despair. Faith, he said, is a leap in the dark, a flying in the face of all the evidence. So actually, the more irrational and absurd faith is, the better. All of which reminds me of that old schoolboy definition of faith. Faith, said the schoolboy, is believing what you know ain't true. That's nonsense, of course, isn't it? Faith does sometimes feel like a huge gamble, I grant you, for faith moves in areas of human awareness where certainty, scientific certainty, is not available. So it will always feel risky. But to suggest that someone should invest their whole life in a proposition for which there's no evidence at all doesn't seem to me to be either responsible or biblical. Rather reminds me of that Hans Christian Andersen fairy tale that Danny Kaye made famous about the emperor's new clothes. Do you remember that? The emperor had been conned by tricksters into buying a magic suit that was supposed to be visible only to the eyes of, what was it, the enlightened in some way. Of course, the suit didn't really exist. It was a con trick. But the emperor didn't want to appear stupid, so he pretended he could see it and proceeded to parade down the city street in it. And all his subjects, anxious to please, said they could see the magic suit too. All except to remember one little boy, the child in the midst, who, to the embarrassment of the bystanders, blurted out in a fit of giggles, "Look at the king, he's as naked as the day he was born." Of course, they dismissed the boy as a fool. These clothes could only be seen by the enlightened, and this child was still nothing but an ignorant infant. And yet, of course, the reverse was actually the case. This juvenile skeptic was actually the only one in the kingdom who wasn't making a fool of himself. And it seems to me that those who jump into religious faith in defiance of any consideration of the evidence risk making a similarly colossal blunder. I mean, just because thousands of people believe that Joseph Smith was a prophet and the Book of Mormon is the only way to heaven doesn't mean it's true, does it? And just because millions of people say Muhammad was a prophet and curse all the infidels, it doesn't mean it's true, does it? That could all be cases of the emperor's new clothes. And just because the majority of Americans believe that Jesus rose from the dead and that only those who believe in him will be saved from the judgment to come, it doesn't mean it's true, does it? That could be a case of the emperor's new clothes too. I think this is quite an important issue because it lies at the heart of why apologetics can't be neglected. Consider these two young people. George is 8 years old. George has an invisible friend. He calls him Dan. Dan Dare. He found Dan Dare in an old comic one day. Dan Dare and George have adventures in spaceships. He can tell you a lot about Dan Dare. He feels he knows him very well. But of course, if you press George on the point, he will admit that Dan Dare isn't real. No, he'll tell you. Dan Dare is a pretend friend. a childhood fantasy, as we would say, a projection of George's imagination. Georgina, on the other hand, is 18 years old. She has an invisible friend. She calls him Jesus. She found him in an old book too, and like George, she talks to her friend and they have adventures together. If you ask Georgina, she will tell you she feels she knows Jesus very well. There's only one difference between her and George. She insists her invisible friend is real. Press her on the point and she will insist Jesus is not a figure of fantasy. Jesus is not a projection of her creative imagination. On the contrary, she would say it was closer to the truth that she was a product of his creative imagination. Does the similarity between those two testimonies, George and Georgina's, does it matter? See, I've met quite a lot of Christians who would say, no, it doesn't. Faith is good for you. Faith, they say, some of them, is a kind of psychic energy that can change the world. It's good to believe it. Believe in something hard enough, it will come true. So the gap between fantasy and reality is really irrelevant for them. Just believe, it's good for you. Some even treat it as a form of psychotherapy, rather like positive thinking, you know. Faith can improve your self-image. Like that book on positive thinking I picked up in an airport over on this side of the pond a few years ago that advised me to stand in front of the mirror every morning and say, I believe, I believe, I believe. This kind of prayer, it says, really flushes the negatives out of the brain. Well, I'm not satisfied by those kind of ideas of faith. I'm sorry. It matters to me whether Georgina is right about her friend Jesus or not. I'm sure there's a lot to be said for a good imagination. It can enrich your life in many ways, but is surely a mark of insanity when you cannot distinguish imaginative fantasy from factual reality. Isn't that how we define insanity? Or have we given up on such distinctions in our postmodern world? I mean, we all build mental castles in the air sometimes, but I am right, aren't I, that it's only the lunatics who try to live in them, and the psychiatrists who try to collect the rent. It reminds me a bit of that scene in Lewis Carroll's Alice in Wonderland, where Alice protests to the Queen of Hearts, "You can't believe impossible things." And the Queen of Hearts replies, "I dare say you haven't had much practice." "When I was your age, I did it for half an hour a day." "Why, sometimes," she says, "I've believed as many as 6 impossible things before breakfast." But actually, that comes pretty close to the counsel that some well-meaning Christians offer to my skeptical friend Tom. "Try harder," they said. "If you want to believe, you can. Just stand in front of that shaving mirror and keep on repeating, I believe, until you've convinced yourself." "It's a matter of decision," they said. "It's a matter of effort." Well, sorry, not good enough for me. Not good enough, I think, for Thomas. Faith is not a matter of decision. What nonsense. Every true convert feels they are facing up to the reality of things, not engaging in some kind of psychologically comforting wish fulfillment. When I became a Christian, I didn't feel I was straining to believe something that I couldn't really accept. I felt I was yielding to something I could no longer doubt. All my psychological and intellectual defences had been broken down by the austere constraint of truth. That's how I felt about it. Now, of course, you may say I was self-deceived, if you want. But unless I genuinely saw it that way, in what sense was I really believing? What induces faith is not the strength of my will to believe. It is the compelling power of the object in which faith is placed. It was not that with much effort I was able to achieve faith, but rather that by no amount of effort could I any longer resist faith. That's why I say it's no good saying to Thomas, "Well, Thomas, try a bit harder. Everybody else believes, why don't you?" No, he was perfectly right to demand evidence. But that brings me to the three things he got wrong. And the first thing he got wrong, I think, was this. He was wrong to lay down conditions about what kind of evidence he judged would suffice to make him a believer. I think he was quite wrong about that. To lay down conditions about what kind of evidence would suffice to make him a believer. You notice how he puts it. "Unless I see the nail marks in his hands, and put my finger where the nails were, and put my hand into his side, I will not believe." This is a conditional clause, isn't it? Those of you who still remember your grammar from school. Unless. And it's a very common ploy. In the days before I became a Christian, it was the card I played all the time. "If God wants me to believe in him," I said to my Christian friends, "let him prove it to me. Let him show me a sign, maybe a miraculous sign. Let him write it in the sky. I am here, yours truly, God. Then I'll believe." Or maybe an intellectual sign. "Come on, demonstrate it to me logically. Prove it to me with QED at the bottom, like we did in geometry at school, you know? Then I'll believe." Or maybe even an experiential sign. I mean, "Let him zap me with some orgy of supernatural emotion. Then I'll maybe believe." But in the absence of such signs, I remain a skeptic. Well, as I say, for all that I support Thomas's desire for evidence to substantiate faith, I have to say he completely misunderstood the nature of faith when he tried to conditionalize it in that way. Faith just doesn't work like that. I mean, for a start, you can't prove Christianity by the kind of proofs we normally call scientific. I may as well be frank with any of you who are not clear on this point. If anybody comes to me from the prove-it-to-me school of skepticism, I have to say you're going to be disappointed. Because whatever line of evidence I provide you with, there are going to be plenty of other interpretations that permit you to retain your skepticism. It is the nature of the animal. I could, for instance, point you, as I often point students in my college in London, to the finely tuned order in the physics of the cosmos, or to the unimaginable complexity of the chemistry of life. I could challenge you that the statistical improbability of such a world makes it much more rational to see it as a product of intelligent design than of pure chance. But if I did that, you might reply, "No, I find pure chance a good enough explanation of the universe, thank you very much. After all, you don't know how many billions of failed universes there have been, do you, before sheer chance threw up the random possibility of this one that we're living in?" And I couldn't prove you wrong about that. Or I could point you to the spiritual experience of countless thousands of people. People who are transparently honest and genuine people who feel they have encountered God personally in their lives. People who will tell you, "You ask me how I know he lives? He lives within my heart." But you could reply, "Well, no doubt these are well-intentioned, nice people, not deliberate liars. But such experiences are all psychologically explicable in non-supernatural terms, you know. I mean, Freud said religion was just a projection of parental dependencies, didn't he? Who can prove him wrong?" Well, I can't. Or I could point you to the historical evidence for the resurrection. I could observe that the tomb must have been empty, or the first enemies of the church in Jerusalem would have brought out the body of Jesus and exploded the disciples' story within a matter of a few days. I could observe how these Christians must have genuinely believed in the resurrection, or they would not have been martyred for Jesus' sake a few years later. But no matter how much first century eyewitness testimony I provide, You could still reply with the 18th century atheist philosopher David Hume, a million people can say something stupid and it's still stupid. It's impossible, he said, that someone should rise from the dead, but not that many witnesses should be mistaken. And that's the trouble with a miracle like the resurrection, you see. Scientifically, it is by definition an anomaly. It's a momentous singularity. And we have no statistical tools to calculate the probability of such singular anomalies. We have no way of assessing the quantity of evidence necessary to accredit such an event. Science deals with repeatable phenomena, and a miracle is by definition non-repeatable, one-off. Science deals with physical causes and physical effects, but a miracle is a physical event with no physical cause. Such a miracle can never be proven. No matter how much evidence you provide, it will never satisfy the scientific skeptic. You just can't verify the truth of Christianity the way Thomas seems to have wanted to do, by empirical investigation. That was the first mistake he made. He put a condition on the kind of evidence that he judged would suffice to make him a believer, and he was wrong. And that brings me to a second and related point. He also, I think, was wrong in that he misunderstood the kind of faith that God wants. The kind of faith that Christ is seeking to awaken. Now, this was something George MacDonald never tired of hammering on about. This is why he talks about the higher faith. Intellectual credence, believing that certain propositional facts are true, is not the same as biblical, evangelical faith. Loads of people believe that God exists. That doesn't make them Christians. Loads of people believe Jesus rose from the dead. That doesn't make them Christians either. When Jesus says, "Believe in me," he's not challenging Thomas just to accept that something happened. He's inviting him into a relationship of trust with himself. Believe in me. It's one thing to say, "I believe Jack is an honest fellow." It's another thing altogether to lend him $100, isn't it? Believe in me, he says. And once you understand faith as personal trust like that, you realize you can't just switch it on. You can't decide to do it. It's more mysterious than that. This sort of faith, this kind of personal trust, well, it's a bit like love. It's a kind of gift. A mysterious gift that it isn't in my power to will unless I've already got it. It can't be self-manufactured. I mean, can you imagine a guy saying to this other guy, "If you do this, I'll fall in love with you." Doesn't work like that, does it? In the same way, you can drown a person's mind with intellectual arguments. You can render them speechless with amazement with miracles. You can paralyze them with emotional ecstasies at some revival meeting. But you cannot create faith like that. People who say, "I'll believe if God meets my conditions," then are just deluding themselves. Because what the Bible means by faith is not susceptible to that kind of proof. Don't be so foolish, then, as to think that the only thing that separates you from faith is the satisfaction of some if clause. If someone's an unbeliever, I put it to you, they don't know what it would take to make them a believer. They have no idea what it would take to make them a believer, any more than they have any idea what it would take to make them fall in love with somebody. And if we become believers, it is not because God has met some condition that we have laid down, therefore. It's because God, in his grace, has decided in some way to reveal himself to us. It is not that we have put God in the test tube and convinced ourselves that he's there, but that he, as the eternal subject, has looked down on us, the object, and recognized that we are there. And that brings me to the third mistake Thomas made, which again is tied up with the other two. He was looking for the wrong kind of miracle. "Unless I see," he says. You know what he said? "Unless I see." He's the archetypal person who believed seeing was believing. And there are still loads of them around. You know, we have some keen, rather superficial Christians in my college. And they're nerds for computers, so many of them, you know, these technophiles at technological universities. They can do anything with computers. And one of them said to me a few months ago, "Oh, Roy, we're working on holographs. Do you know, soon we'll be able, using holograms, to project an image in front of people's eyes of Jesus doing the miracles in the Gospels. They'll be able to sit there and it'll be just as real as, you know, you and me looking at one another now. 3D, right there in the middle of the room, he'll raise Lazarus from the dead. 3D, right there in the middle of the room, he'll turn the water into wine. 3D, right there in the middle of the room, he'll rise from the dead himself. Once we can do that, Roy, everyone will believe, won't they?" My goodness, I wish they taught them some theology along with their computer science. "Unless I see." It's the wrong kind of miracle. I can understand why he said that. See, his problem seemed superficially due to the fact that he had missed out on a visual experience of the risen Jesus. The other disciples had seen him with their own eyes and Thomas hadn't. So he naturally assumed that was the cause of his doubt. But as Jesus goes on to highlight in his interaction with Thomas, you see, that in point of fact was not the issue at all. Just notice carefully what happens. A week later, there is a rerun of the first appearance of Jesus. Only this time, Thomas is present. Jesus deliberately picks him out and offers himself to skeptical Thomas, just as Thomas had demanded. "Come on, Thomas," he says. "Do your experiments. I'm here in the test tube, waiting for you to convince yourself I'm really alive, if that's what's really bothering you." But suddenly, you see, it seems that all Thomas's conditional clauses have evaporated away. Where is this rationalist skeptic with all his demands for empirical proof? He's disappeared. In fact, the impertinence of his unbelief becomes almost an embarrassment to him. To think that he had demanded a scientific investigation of the risen Jesus as faith's ultimatum. Now we read of no impudent, probing fingers. We read only of a confession. "My Lord and my God." What's changed? All right, he's seen the risen Jesus now, but has anything really changed? I mean, if Jesus was a ghost or a hallucination before when his friends saw him, why couldn't he be a ghost or a hallucination now? Is seeing really believing? Is it really the quantity of the evidence or the intensity of the evidential experience that really is the issue? Well, the implication of the story is that isn't the issue. And Jesus, in fact, as if to reinforce the point, highlights it, knocks Thomas between the eyes with it. "Because you have seen me, you have believed." I think that's really a question mark. Is it because you have seen me that you have believed? Is that what's made the difference, Thomas? No. Blessed are those who have not seen and yet have believed. See, if the Christian faith could only advance on the basis of the kind of miraculous experience Thomas was demanding, it would go nowhere. Jesus says the kind of faith I'm looking for does not require such experiences. Seeing is not believing, not when you're talking about the kind of belief I'm looking for. True faith is a response generated not by visible signs, but by the invisible operation of the Spirit of God confirming and establishing a conviction about unseen things in the human heart. That's what you have to understand about faith, Thomas. True faith is not generated by visible signs, but by the invisible operation of the Spirit of God confirming and establishing a conviction about unseen things within the human heart. Plenty of people saw the risen Jesus and did not believe. The Gospels tell us so. If I could conjure the risen Jesus before your eyes in a hologram here and now, it wouldn't make you a believer if you're an unbeliever. Unless God accompanies that vision by the inward spiritual opening of a person's heart, it makes no difference at all. And if that miracle in the heart is achieved, the visual sign becomes redundant. Remember what Jesus said to Peter? Flesh and blood has not revealed this to you, but my Father in heaven. Once the heart is opened, all miraculous displays are rendered superfluous and redundant. That's why Jesus says, blessed are those who have not seen and yet believe. Oh, I'm not going back on what I said earlier about the importance of evidence. There is evidence, enough evidence to make this faith a rational faith. Jesus does not ask anyone to jump into any kind of irrational fanaticism that ignores valid intellectual reservations. There is eyewitness testimony of honest men who did see him risen from the dead. But the difference between the person who is confronted by that apostolic testimony and is converted by it, and the person who engages with that same New Testament testimony but says, I can find alternative explanations, thank you very much. That difference has nothing to do with the quality or quantity of the evidence. It has everything to do with those words of Thomas. My Lord, my God. You notice that first person pronoun? He's testifying here to an inner experience of discipleship. My Lord and my God. He is engaging with this risen Jesus at the level of his heart and soul, not just his eyes. And that is the real miracle. As MacDonald would say, it's not a matter of believing something happened. X is true. It's about the generation of an interpersonal relationship with the living Christ. So I have a question for any skeptic, either here or anywhere. If Jesus were alive from the dead, would you really want to believe in him? Here is the testimony of a group of people who saw him alive from the dead, and I think their testimony is sufficient. It has proven sufficient for millions of Christians. Why isn't it sufficient for you? Could it be the real barrier lies not in your eyes, which haven't seen, not even in your mind, which cannot decide to believe, but in your heart? What was it Thomas said? I will not believe. Yes, he was a determined skeptic at the beginning, wasn't he? Some people are. I don't know if I've told this story before. It's one of my favourites. It's about the man who went to see his doctor. And he sat in front of the doctor's desk and he said, Doctor, I'm dead. Nonsense, said the doctor. How can you possibly be dead? He said, I am dead, and nothing you say could possibly convince me otherwise. But the doctor thought for a while, and then he had an idea. He took a scalpel out of his drawer. He said to the guy, now, Dead men don't bleed, do they? The man thought for a moment and then he nodded. That's true, dead men don't bleed. Give me your thumb. Gave him his thumb, took the scalpel, jabbed it in. There, he said, what's that? Well, 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 dead men do bleed. Could it be that it is the determination of our scepticism, the resolution of it, I will not believe, that is the real problem? Could it be it's not so much lack of evidence, so much as a fundamental unwillingness to surrender, like that rich young man, remember? He lacked one thing. Faith is a blessing. Jesus says that here. Blessed are those, he says. It's a divine gift. But God does not prostitute that blessing, that gift, on the idly curious or the obstinately proud. It is reserved for people like Thomas, who, when they receive it, respond, my Lord and my God. Sometimes, you know, I think people who complain they have no faith, actually, deep down, they do. They're just looking for the wrong kind of faith. They think faith is something different from what it really is. Their expectations are misplaced. Perhaps you know more than you think you know. That's certainly how it was with me. You know, I think I knew the Christian message was true months and months before I was humble enough to confess, yes, I am a believer. I think back to my friend Tom. Was he an unbeliever or wasn't he? Even now, I'm not sure. Maybe he just was looking for the wrong kind of evidence. Looking for the wrong kind of faith, imagining that Christian experience was different from the kind of experience he thought it really was. I don't know, but I do know this. One morning, he came down to breakfast, and he said to me, Roy, last night in my room, I realized that Jesus was alive. I mean, really alive. And I've never been so excited in all my life. What made the difference? I have no idea. Oh, he'd been to a few apologetics meetings. Maybe that had cleared a few unnecessary intellectual hindrances away in his head. But the apologetics hadn't made him a believer. There had been quite a good evangelistic meeting in our IV chapter a few days before, and I know he'd been affected by the speaker, but there was no immediate change in Tom. No, somehow, in his room, on his own, that night, some encounter had happened. I have no way to explain it, rationalize it. But from that day on, he never felt like the odd one out anymore. Perhaps that's why I'm an evangelical. Why I believe in conversion. Because I really do believe God's Spirit is still doing that. That the risen Jesus is still kindling faith. Not through people seeing things with their eyes, but encountering him in the depths of their hearts and souls. Because you have seen me, Thomas, you have believed. Blessed are those who have not seen and yet have believed. A few moments of quietness before we sing our closing hymn.